5 p.m. President of Representative Ulmer, Taylor, Barnes, and Son Chair. Today, before the committee, we have House Bill 106 dealing with restitution, and 114, bail sureties, and 122, civil compromise. We're hooked into a teleconference system on the House Bill 106 to start with. We have two different teleconferences. One is area-wide, and one is off-net, which is going to be the surety bill. I think that's 114. So we have from now, I'd like to go till about 2:15 on the restitution bill, from 2:15 to about 2:30 on the compromise of misdemeanors. And then at 2:30, we're going to switch into a separate teleconference on the surety bill, 114. And it would be the chair's intention to try to move 114 today if we can get that far. So if we can start with House Bill 106. Who do we have here? Representative Cotton has joined us. Representative Davidson, do you want to start off the testimony on House Bill 106? This seems to be a favorite Kodiak issue. Your predecessor had this bill here last year. We'll see where we go. But like I said, I'd like to get testimony on 106 up to about 2:15 or so. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Cliff Davidson, and as prime sponsor of the bill, indeed it is a continuation of efforts in the past from Kodiak. My primary interest in this bill is to ensure that victims of violent acts in our society are given due assistance in dealing with matters that befall them as victims. The sectional analysis that has been provided for you pretty much explains what we're trying to do by the addition of the language in the statute. And I will keep my comments brief because I know there are other people who wish to comment. In the first section, we're simply trying to say that the people who commit acts of violence on others should, in fact, be responsible for those who care and in the way of services, or providing services such as shelter, counseling, medical, or dental kinds of things. Those perpetrators should, in fact, be forced to pay for the damage that they have done. The second part of the act, of the bill, rather, simply places the burden up on the defendant as to whether or not he can afford to pay. It's one of those situations, well, geez, I can't afford it, then he will be forced to prove that he cannot afford it. So I think that given the statistics on violence in our state, I think it's imperative that we make people realize who are into this kind of thing, that if they play in this way, that they will have to pay. And so with those comments, I will turn over to other people who wish to testify, and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, I'd like to note Representative Navarre and Gruenberger with us. Are there any questions of Representative Davidson? Okay, I just have a couple comments I'd like to say. This bill was before the committee last year and had extensive hearings, I think, and comments. And we'll probably just hold off to go through there. But I'll just raise a couple issues if people are testifying that I would like to see addressed that I raised last year. And basically is where, how do we define these costs in terms of like line 13, line 12? What is counseling? Who is a counselor? Is it the receptionist in a shelter? Is there a value placed on that? As far as I know, counseling is not defined in the statute as a profession or in that issue. And shelter services, how do we define what shelter services cost? And how do we get into that issue? And then on my other comment, I'd like maybe some people could testify is on page 2, lines 11 through 16. It appears it's a debtor prison type situation where if the person can't pay, he goes to jail. That means the rich get out and the poor spend work off their debts in jail. And I'm not sure if that's a public policy call or not, but I'd sure like to hear some testimony on those points, and Representative Davidson, we're not going to get this bill out of here today, so I just want to raise those issues that we can work on them, and we'll take the teleconference testimony minutes. Representative Taylor, you got a comment?
Are we going to do markup at this time, or are we just going to take testimony?
No, we're just going to try to take testimony and limit the questions to clarifying the legislation at this time. Thank you, Cliff.
Thank you.
Do we have other people here in the room that need to testify that do not live in Juneau?
I put my name on the list and it's listed.
Okay, do you live here in Juneau, Ruth?
No, I live in Fairbanks.
Okay, why don't you join us at the end of the table, and I want to get the people that are just through town, and then we'll go to the teleconference before we go to people who live here full time. You have to turn the switch forward on the teleconference one.
Yes,
no, just flip the switch.
I just wanted to clarify, we're only testifying on the restitution bill and not on civil compromise.
Yeah. Could you identify yourself for the tape recorder?
My name is Ruth Lister, and I'm the director of Women in Crisis, which is a domestic violence sexual assault program in Fairbanks, and also president of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I had some limited testimony on the restitution bill. I think definitely in principle, I agree with the concept of the bill and would like to see it pass or some form of it pass. And I guess I just wanted to address a couple of concerns. The first is that I think it would be good to add a bit of language to make it perfectly clear that this is not going to be an alternative to jail time and or treatment for perpetrators. If at sentencing the judge says, well, okay, pay her dental bills and the lost time that she had at work and the child care expenses incurred by her having to come to the trial or something like that, that's not seen as the solution, because that isn't the solution in stopping the problem. It, in fact, may just exacerbate the problem. And I think that could be added to the language so that it was clear. The second area was in, I guess I premise it first of all that I think it's very good to have the restitution in there for the victim, and the areas where she would need to be reimbursed I think can be made fairly clear, and hopefully the word and financial burden will cover all of that. As far as restitution to a shelter program or to another program that is providing services, for example, in child sexual abuse treatment for a victim, my concern is that those aren't so immediate. There may be some longer-term costs in counseling or legal advocacy or even in shelter that go beyond the sentencing, because ideally with perpetrators of domestic violence, one hopes to have the sentencing happen fairly rapidly, and often they plead out on those cases, and then they are put in a treatment program either for alcohol or for the violence itself if that's available. So, and I don't know how you address that, but it would be less easy for the shelter programs, I think, to have come up with a figure for the services that the victim is going to need at the time of sentencing, because often those services are ongoing. Similarly, for the offender, he's going to probably need to be in the program for 26 weeks, so that's ongoing after the sentencing, and the victim also often needs some longer-term services. I think that it's not going to be very hard for us to define what the costs of shelter and counseling are. Some of the programs have already done this where they're getting reimbursement from the military for military dependents, and so those kinds of figures I know that I've done for my program, and I'm sure that working with the council, the programs could do that. And would probably find those costs to be a good deal lower than if you were contracting out to the private sector. Because I don't want to make suggestions for radical changes. And I think the bill, the way it is basically fairly good. However, another way of looking at it might be to say, is assess the person a fine the way you do in DWI, on the premise that for most perpetrators of violence, unless something is done, there's going to be some escalation of that. So although you can't say the way they did with DWI that this person is a potential killer on the road, in fact, in the long run, they might be a potential killer. So you could assess a fine, and that fine would either go to the shelter program or to a central fund in the state, and then get dispersed out either through Council on Domestic Violence or something else like that. That might be an alternative if you come up with too many problems in how to do restitution back to a shelter program. I guess as far as the debtor's prison situation, most of the men who batter that we see in our program don't have very much money. Often they immediately sign over their, some of them sign over their assets to other family members. And so I don't think it's going to be a large way to get money, but I do think it's a good start. And especially as far as restitution to the victim goes, I think it's important that it doesn't fall on her to be the collection agency as well.
Representative Grunberg?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing you said...
You've got to speak directly into these mics or they're not going to pick in. They're very directional, so you got to keep them right in front of you.
Okay. One thing you said struck a bell with me. That people are in the habit of transferring assets to avoid having to make payments to you. Are you finding a lot of what appear to be fraudulent conveyances here?
I think that's something that the Anchorage program, I think, has seen more than we have in Fairbanks. What we're seeing mostly in Fairbanks is that many of the people in batterers, their domestic violence offenders, are unemployed.
Thank you.
Representative Taylor?
I guess that's the point I'd make.
Got a mic there. Yes.
Are you now applying, or are your victims applying to the courts during sentencing for restitution?
Generally not.
Why not?
This is in misdemeanor cases.
Well, I think that's the...
Yeah, and that's what this is mostly...
Majority of
although it, it would also apply a user for sexual assault or sexual abuse cases, which are felony cases. I think that a lot falls on the woman, and... No, that's not always good. There is some application for restitution, but a lot of that falls upon her and her fears around what will happen with that. And so I think that if she had more advocacy, that would work better.
We're not talking about her acting as an advocate. I'm asking whether or not you, as a person who runs the shelter, apply for the very same funds that you're going to be asked to apply for under this statute.
In for the victim.
For yourself, yeah, for the victim. Because are you, in other words, is anybody going into court saying to the judges, cost money to put these folks up, Judge, and as a consequence?
Oh, all right. I see what you mean.
That's paid.
Yeah, that has been tried in a couple of cases. Actually, restitution has been given out once, I think, in Anchorage, once in Juneau. We haven't met with any success. I don't know, a couple of times in Fairbanks, we have not met with much success on that is judges are not willing to do that. And so I think that any bill like this, there's going to have to be some education in the judicial system.
You mean to tell me you have actually been making application and you've been turned down by the judges?
Not on a regular basis.
Well, I didn't think so. I haven't heard of it at any time being turned down. In fact, I'd be shocked if it was. If you're going to make any kind of restitution, you're going to see to it the victim's taken care of.
Representative Taylor, I'd just like to interject this. And I see Gail Horetsky is with us too, maybe we'll get into it, but does the shelter have an independent cause of action to apply for restitution, or does only the victim can apply for restitution? And I think that's kind of a clarifying point. I'm not sure the shelter can go into court on its own on its third-party motion.
Well, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, well, my understanding is the cases where it has been awarded, it's pretty much the judge doing it without people going in and making specific application for it.
Gail's with us here, and she may be able to clarify that for us.
I'll go into those points.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to know if it was a matter of practice, whether they were even attempting to collect anything where their victims were. Yeah. Apparently they're not.
Okay. Representative Ulmer?
On that same subject, I doubt very
you
much
use your
that...
teleconference.
I'm sorry. I doubt very much that in any of these cases, the shelter is a party to the action. I mean, the shelter isn't there at the table. The question is really between, the victim and the judge and defense attorney. And if the victim or the victim's attorney asks for it, it might be considered. I doubt very much that shelters are in any way involved in these proceedings. So I just, unless we create something which creates, in essence, a burden upon the judge to consider this, it simply hasn't been an issue. So I don't think that the shelters are to be faulted in any way for not asking, because they're not there.
Well, that's why I was asking the question, to find out if they were trying to participate. Apparently they have, and to those extent where somebody brought it to the judge's attention, something was done about it. My frustration here is that it isn't the judge's burden to do this. She has an attorney, he's the district attorney. He is in court. He certainly sees to it, at least in the 6 years I sat on the bench, I certainly inquired, and they told me about what were the hospital bills, how much time was off from work, and I saw to it that restitution was done. And I think you'll find that your judiciary already has this authority, but instead of them giving a bill to the victim that the victim can then present to the judge, they now want a separate cause of action on their own. That's the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I...
That may be more efficient. I don't know.
Ms. Lister, do you have any further testimony? We're kind of discussing amongst ourselves here right now.
I mean, I think it'd be probably better for Gail Horetsky to address that, because she knows the legal issues that are in there.
Okay. Is there any other questions? Okay, perhaps Gail will ask you to give some testimony, and then I want to get out in the teleconference network to let those people offer some testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky, and I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, appearing before you on HB 106 regarding restitution. Mr. Chairman, there are some very sort of nitpicky technical comments that I wanted to offer for the committee's consideration. And I don't know if you want me to offer those suggestions now or later in a work group, address myself to broad policy considerations or what?
Why don't you address some policy considerations, point out your small points here, and then we can, you know, we're just going to try to take testimony today.
Okay. Well, to begin with, we certainly support the concept of the bill and anything that makes it easier for a victim, any victim, to be recompensed for his or her medical expenses, other expenses that are directly incurred as a result of the crime. We certainly would support those efforts. Vis-a-vis just technical issues, Mr. Chairman, on the bill, the way it's now presently structured is there is a current provision in the law, and that's 045, that talks about restitution. And of course it envisions restitution to the victim, which is what restitution has typically been. And then the new language which is added, which is on lines 11 through 14 on the first page, including restitution to a private or nonprofit organization, merely, Mr. Chairman, as a technical matter, we would suggest perhaps putting that in a separate subsection, because you're talking about a different animal here. You're talking about restitution to a third party for services provided to the victim, not restitution to the victim for out-of-pocket losses. And I think that it's a legitimate public policy consideration whether you want to expand the concept of restitution to include these shelters, which are performing a very valuable service for society, but it's a new animal, and perhaps the factors might be different. You want to lift out specific factors to be considered, etc. I think it would make sense to put it in a new subsection. Regarding the four factors, Mr. Chairman, that are listed on page one there that the court should consider, we're running into a couple of overlaps with existing law. For example, existing AS 1255.100, which is, specifies the conditions of probation, subsection A2 of that statute says restitution may be provided for actual damages or loss caused by crime. In other words, that statute defines more or less what restitution means, at least as imposed as a condition of probation. And there was a specific Supreme Court case, it was Sprague versus State, 1979, in which the court decided...
This is Anchorage, we're not hearing you, Juno, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You got to speak right into the mic. Yeah.
Thank you. In the Sprague case, the court specifically concluded that punitive damages were not authorized by that language in 1255-100. In other words, what restitution means is payment for out-of-pocket expenses. And subsection number four, where it talks about need of the victim and society for punitive compensation, you either have to redefine what restitution is and say, and we mean it to include punishment, which has traditionally been what fines, the purpose that fines serve, or that subsection 4 has to come out of there, because it doesn't make any sense in the guise of a restitution award. Typically, for those people who are not attorneys, typically punitive damages are awarded in the context of a civil case, and it's to punish the offender and as an incentive for good behavior in the future. And as I say, in a criminal case, generally fines have undertaken.
We've lined up all the non-lawyers on the left-hand side of the table.
All right, so I look over there when I...
Yeah.
Okay.
We do have something in common, don't we?
That's it, Dan. Again, we endorse the concept of more or less placing the burden of showing that the failure to pay restitution was excusable, i.e. was not intentional or willful. The problem with this, and I speak from personal experience, is when someone hasn't paid a fine or hasn't paid restitution, the DA files a motion to go back in, it's like a contempt of court motion, and we bear the burden of proving that that was an intentional failure. Well, we don't have that guy's checkbook, we don't know what his outlay was last month, we don't know if his daughter has been sick. It's not information to which we are easily are able to gain access. So this, in the context of a sentencing, where you're not talking about determination of guilt, you're merely talking about a sentencing issue, as a constitutional matter, it would be allowable to shift the burden, if I can use that phrase, to him to show that he didn't have any choice, he didn't have the money. That's a policy decision whether you want to do that, but I don't think, Mr. Chairman, it presents any constitutional problems because we've already determined guilt and we're now in the sentencing phase. Specifically, again, as a technical matter, the language on the second page, lines 14 through 17, state may enforce payment of the fine, recipient may enforce payment of restitution under AS 935. I think I understand what they're trying to do there. I would, however, point out for the committee's consideration the existing law, AS 12.55.025, subsection F, which provides that a sentence that a defendant pay money either as a fine or as restitution constitutes a lien in the same manner as a judgment for money in a civil action. So if they intend to replace that language with this proposed language, then that other ought to be repealed. If it's merely not realizing that that other section is already in law, then maybe this new proposed language doesn't need to be in there.
What was that site again?
Yes, sir. It's AS 12.55.025F, as in Frank.
Okay.
It's on the second page, lines 14 through 17.
Mr. Chairman, it sounds to me like if we were to delete something in here, all
no
we would
numbers.
Have to delete is the phrase, quote,
Max.
Under ASO 9.35.
Max, please use the mic.
If we were to delete something in the bill, it would be just deleting the phrase under ASO 9.35, right?
Okay. I'd just like to take general testimony. We're not in a markup case right now. We only got about another 15, 20 minutes on this. I want to get as many people in as we can.
Just two more points, Mr. Chairman, and then if there were any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them. You had asked a general question, sir, about concern about the language on the second side, whether that constitutes basically a debtor's prison, that is, the people who can't afford to pay go to jail and those who can do not. And I can assure you that that is not the case, Mr. Chairman, and direct your attention or committee counsel's attention to Lominac, L-O-M-I-N-A-C versus Anchorage, Court of Appeals case, February 1983, in which the court specifically held that a person may only be imprisoned for failure to pay court-ordered restitution if the failure to pay was intentional or the result of bad faith. And reversing a decision from Anchorage District Court where a judge had found that the woman's, in that case it was a woman defendant, that the woman's failure to pay had not been intentional but put her in jail anyway or ordered that she go to jail. And the court had no problem with reversing that order and saying, hey, the statute says intentional, that's what you have to show, and if you don't show that, she or he doesn't go to jail. Which is why this shifting of the burden becomes so important, because now, we always did, the language was always in there, but it's very clear now that we, the state or the municipality, has to prove lack of good faith, moving of assets around, buying a new car while the children starve, that kind of thing, and that's hard to prove if you don't have access to financial.
Could you give us a copy of the case or the site, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And a question came up when we were discussing this bill regarding whether current law restitution would allow compensation to a victim for out-of-pocket expenses such as loss of income from work while she was in the hospital, loss of income from work while she had to go testify in court, transportation expenses, daycare expenses, etc. I would just like to call the committee's attention to a provision that was added last year, actually, by the legislature and it's found in the supplement. It's an amendment to AS 12.55.045, the statute being amended in this bill. And it's new subsection D, and it says, in a case in which the defendant is convicted of a violation of, and it refers to the theft statute, in which the property is commercial fishing gear, the court shall consider the victim's need for and may order restitution, including compensation for loss of income. And we pointed out at the time that it perhaps might not seem fair that only commercial fishermen were eligible for compensation for loss of income, but the bill passed and ultimately became law. So the court may want to, this committee, excuse me, may want to consider looking at that subsection, whether it might be appropriate at this point to broaden it.
Yeah, that was another Kodiak bill.
It was, as a matter of fact. That's my prepared remarks. I'd certainly be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions to Ms. Horetzky? She is available here at Juneau for...
I'd have a budget markup.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd ask Gail to be back when we mark the bill up if we could.
Be glad to. Thank you.
I'd like to go on the teleconference network to Kodiak now. We have an Elaine Loomis in Kodiak.
Yes, thank you. This is Elaine Loomis. I'm the social worker for the Kodiak Area Native Association, and I'm here in support of the bill. My concern is the need for a bill such as this for the victims that live in the villages on our island. I see with my caseload right now, I have 22 clients that are victims of child sexual assault. Most of them have gone through a trial process. Although I have testified at sentencing, the damage to, you know, my comments on the damage to these girls has been, I haven't been told that they have the ability to have counseling paid for or to go to Anchorage and have evaluations or any of that one mentioned earlier that's already available. So I see this as directly having a positive effect for the village victims. One of my concerns is that it addressed not only counseling, but out-of-pocket expenses for airfare, hotel, because, you know, as many people know on Kodiak Island, when you come into town or you go to Anchorage, you don't know if you're going to get weathered in and not be able to make a short trip.
Okay, thank you, Elaine. Are there any comments or questions from the committee? Okay, having none, I appreciate your testimony. We're going to go to Anchorage. I don't have a list there, but the first person in Anchorage.
Yes, Carrie Longoria is the first person in Anchorage.
Carrie Longoria.
Good afternoon, can you hear me?
Yes, please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Carrie Longoria, and I'm testifying today on behalf of STAR. STAR is an Anchorage-based sexual assault agency which deals primarily with sexual assault victims and their loved ones and families. I'm testifying to go on the record as supporting House Bill 106. We're extremely supportive of this bill in view of the fact that I just added up some figures from the Violent Crimes Compensation Grant Program, and I found out that roughly one-fifth of the total amount of monies that were granted were for sexual assault victims. And I'm sure that many of the committee members already know that Alaska continues to lead the nation in sexual assault. And in terms of children, we rate at least 60% higher than the nation's average. So I think that in terms of making allowances for victims and for programs to be recompensated, I think this is also great. Chairman Sun, you had a question about how you can evaluate what kind of compensation can be made for the programs and for the victims. And I haven't had a chance to actually sit down and work at any unique formula. I don't know if there is one. But I do know that in our state we do have a violent crimes compensation program. I'm not sure what formula they use. I do know that the FBI also has a formula. They also point out that the highest economic median loss for all victims are those that are experienced by sexual assault victims. So meaning to say that sexual assault victims experience a higher economic median loss than any other kind of victim. I'm not sure what formula they use either, but I'm sure that we can find one. I haven't had a chance to go over the bill nearly as well as Gail Horetzky, and I'm very happy that she testified. I had some questions which she cleared up. But I did want to go down the record as being supportive of the bill on behalf of STAR, and if you'd like to ask me some questions, I'm open for that.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked one of the ladies earlier, and that is, have you found a high incidence of fraudulent conveyances whereby people are transferring their property so they don't have to pay restitution?
Representative Gruenberg, I would defer that to the district attorney's office here in Anchorage. Primarily what we do, again, as a third party, is we give the information to the victim and we let them know that restitution is a possibility, and they can request that from the district attorney's office or the attorney that is working with them if it's a private suit. So I would request that you ask someone here in the Anchorage area.
Thank you.
Representative Taylor?
Yes, this is Representative Taylor. As a normal practice at this time and over the last short period, I guess, has it been your policy and practice to deliver to each of the people that you treat, or at least the adult member of that group, a bill for your services?
No, we do not request money. We are a nonprofit agency which originally was created out of volunteers. There has been a considerable amount of pressure, however, placed upon us, mostly by local assembly members, to begin to consider fees. Otherwise, we were not going to be granted some funding for this past year and this coming next year. So that certainly is some pressure that's now beginning to develop on our end.
Well, I understand some pressure may be developing. Are you today giving bills to any of the people?
No, Representative, we are not doing that. It has been our policy, and it is our understanding right now that the majority of individuals that are victims are very low income. We, not to say that victims are never high income, but those that we are now seeing are low income. And unfortunately, there's no study to reflect whether or not the individuals, if we were able to bill, which we do not do, if we did bill, whether or not they would be able to pay for those fees.
I guess that's kind of what I'm getting at. Right now, you are a nonprofit organization, and you provide your services for free to those people who qualify for it. So there, in essence, there is nothing to compensate that victim for as far as the cost of your services, because you've not billed the victim, nor have you informed the district attorney or anyone else of what amount the judge should order the defendant to reimburse you or the victim for those services, are you?
No, we're not. As a matter of fact, up until the time that this bill has been presented, it's never been a possibility or a consideration. Our primary focus is not to reimburse our services, but to provide services for the victim. So if you will understand and keep that in mind, that our primary focus is to assist the victim throughout the system. And for someone who is usually still in trauma or in crisis, our focus is not to consider how we'll be compensated. Our focus is to make sure that this person gets through whatever they have to get through. And if compensation is possible or restitution, we certainly keep that in mind as well.
I might mention that, Mr. Chairman, and to the speaker, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mental Health Organization, whose catchment area includes all of District 1, has been for many years sending out bills for the services that they render to the very people we're talking about. Some of these people that are involved in sexual assault cases end up involved with the Gateway Mental Health people for counseling, and that is also a nonprofit group, and they have been billing out for their services, so you knew that there was a cost, and the judge did have an opportunity to see to it that the victim got compensated for those costs. I think it's a new thing for the various shelters to go into, but I think it may be very well a good thing for them to go into to help in funding.
Okay, any other comments from the committee? If not, thank you. I'd like to go to Rangel for the next person in Rangel.
This is Pat Connedy in Rangel. Hopefully you can hear me. I heard portions of Ms. Horesky's comments. I didn't hear it all because I arrived late. I had to run down from court. I have worked on this legislation for a couple of years, so I'm fairly much familiar with it. I would like to add some comments. Of course, the department has always been very much in favor of it, which I think Ms. Horesky has already stated. I would like to add a couple of comments that I'm not sure whether Ms. Horesky covered or not. One had to do with the conflict, or not the conflict, but the particularly the language on lines 14 through 17 on page 2 regarding enforcement of a restitution order under 0935. That is, in our view, redundant to the language that is in 1255.025F. The second portion of the comment that I would like to make is has to do with the whole structure of 1255.051 as it's rewritten. You have amended 045, which addresses the restitution aspect of the law, and 051 addresses both restitution and fines. If you will look in the section of the statute, and I believe it's 1255.040, and I don't have statutes in front of me, that address court fines, similar language is contained in there, language which was referred to in the Carr case, which has created a lot of the problems. That is, before a defendant can be ordered to pay a fine, the court must make a finding, a twofold finding, regarding his ability to pay and the effect of the payment on his on something. That sort of creates a conflict between 1255.051 unless that portion of the existing law is amended. The final thing I would like to say is in the new 045A, subsection 4, I believe is just out of place. Restitution is not a punitive sanction. Rather, it is a system whereby we make victims whole, and it's just inappropriate to restructure restitution as a punitive sanction all the way around. I answer any questions.
Pat, thanks for testifying. We're not going to mark this up today, and I assume you'll be back in Juneau at some time, and perhaps we can get some of your testimony in writing on that. So I want to get some other general testimony in, and I'm going to go back to Anchorage if they have anybody else there to testify.
We just have one more comment from Anchorage.
Okay, go ahead.
Representative Sun, this is Carrie Longoria again. I didn't get a chance to respond to the last question. I actually just wanted to stress a point, and that's that our crisis center deals primarily with individuals who are in crisis, and I think it would be very, very difficult at a time when a person is at the hospital or at the police department to provide them with the bill, or even to provide them with the bill at a later time. Again, and that's generally because of the nature of our agency. And I also think I'm not clear on the provisions of services for the mental health agency, which you spoke of earlier, but those individuals may be in a position where they are more able to evaluate whether or not they want to even accept the services. At least in what we provide, the services are so necessary and so important that I just think it would be a little more difficult to ask something like that.
Okay, this is Chairman Sund. I just note that if this restitution is going to go into effect, you're going to have to figure out how much you're going to ask for restitution, so probably be something that'll have to be developed in the system, but thanks for your comment. I'd like to go to Galena. I had one person down here from Galena with a question.
This is Laura Osborne, a moderator. We're just online to observe. We don't really have anyone here to testify.
Okay, then my list is over. Is there anybody else on the teleconference network that would like to testify on this bill?
Chairman, this is Elaine Loomis from Kodiak again, and I would just like to stress again that though there is a mental health center in Kodiak and a Native Profit nonprofit organization that does travel to the village, our village trips are quarterly, and to meet the needs of these sexual assault victims, they need more intensive counseling than once a quarter, which again calls for them to either travel into town or to Anchorage. And so this, I would really like to stress that this bill cover more than just the counseling fee, but the cost for the victim to get to the services that are available.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have anybody in Juneau here? Barbara, did you want to testify?
My name is Barbara Nichols, and I'm Director for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And since I'm not a lawyer, I've learned a lot today, and so you'll have to bear with me because I have a lot of concerns based on the conversation I heard today. One of the issues that Representative Taylor brought up, which I think is very important, is when this bill was presented, it was my understanding that really shelters could not collect restitution as it exists right now, and that we had to put something in there in order for them to do it. if we put something in the bill that says shelters may collect restitution, I just want it very clear that they will never be an intrusive party in this action because of confidentiality, which is a major concern of ours. So the shelter would never be able to tell the judge, yes, this victim stayed in the shelter. It would be up to the victim always to tell the judge that the victim stayed in the shelter. So for that reason, I've never felt that this bill would engender that much money, as maybe other people have thought, because it's going to be very few cases. And if that's already possible now, which I have heard that it's happened in Sitka and Juneau, then maybe we need to rethink that whole thing. And it was my misunderstanding because I wasn't an attorney. So I wanted to clarify that. And I guess the other issue that I really want to clarify is the issue of collecting fees and council-funded programs, because STAR and Anchorage is a council-funded program. And we have a grant condition that the programs will do their best to collect fees. And it has been my understanding that STAR has been collecting fees for long-term counseling. So I will definitely clear that up with the program. But I want you to know that we have made an effort for at least the last 3 or 4 years to collect fees. And I do know that they've collected money from violent crimes compensation, so there has to be some kind of fee schedule there. And we need to get that cleared up. But in regards to confidentiality, I just would like to impress upon you how a shelter can never, ever give up that strong adherence to confidentiality. And so the only way that the court would ever know that the victim had services at a shelter is when the victim herself or himself actually says that that's happening. So other than that, I support the concept of the bill because, as everyone else says, having money for the shelters is very important, especially in these times. So anything that will engender more money for the programs, which I think are very needed in the state, I support. But I see some complications here that are probably above and beyond me. And I do want you to remember confidentiality when you're considering the bill.
Yeah, I would just note for the record, I'm not absolutely sure, but I know the Violent Crimes Compensation Commission has come up 2 or 3 times here. I think they've been zeroed out in the proposed budget, we may have to get their formula from them real quick.
Well, I do know how they pay. What they pay is fees for services, and so they must have a bill. They pay out-of-pocket expenses. So, in fact, when STAR has gotten money for violent crimes compensation, that means that there's been some kind of bill that has to go to violent crimes compensation. And we do have other programs that have presented violent crimes with bills.
Representative Taylor?
I guess that's why I was asking the questions I was earlier. I really thank you for your candid comment, Laura, because it was my understanding that some of these institutions were sending out some bills, and that I think to be done properly, you need to bill all people who receive services, whether or not they have the ability to pay. And then you make that determination, and you can write right on it. This one didn't have the ability to pay or whatever. But I know that mental health is doing it, and some of these institutions are doing it. And the way the law is presently set up, if the victim actually has a bill in her hand, or she knows she's going to get a quote bill for X amount of dollars, she gives that to the district attorney at sentencing, and he says, here's how much it cost her to get her face sewed up. And I think that's where you have to draw a philosophical distinction between what's the purpose of a criminal courtroom and what's the purpose of a civil courtroom. And the two protections that are provided for both victim and perpetrator in each of those. And I think that this thing can work, but I think the law is already there sufficient. If they will get into the same billing kind of structures that other agencies have, they will receive the same type of treatment, because the courts now have the authority to do it.
Well, the one thing, may I comment on that?
Go ahead.
I don't want to get too carried away, but one comment that I would have about that is that there are certain kinds of services, like Carrie Longoria was mentioning, crisis intervention services, and it's not very easy. It's not the same as a counseling session. We could come up very easily with the value of a shelter night, but whether we want to give a bill to every person that comes into the shelter when we know that they may not, we know definitely they don't have the money, the billing system may become so cumbersome that in fact it's not cost effective. So I think that if this bill then allows to collect the value of the services, we can easily come up with that. And that to me is a separate issue from setting up a billing system.
You just bill the people that you think that are going to be able to collect from. So. Mm-hmm.
My only concern with that, Mr. Chairman, is some legislation I think we're going to run into in another area too here later on, and that is the problem that you have with the term indigency, because the guy can be indigent in our country in the first part of March, and then he can make a Cachet's herring opening and have $25,000 in his back pocket at the end of March, then turn right around and be indigent again by May, and working each of the programs and fly off to Bristol Bay and be back with $50,000 in his back pocket after another 6 to 8 weeks. So indigency is totally a period of time. And it's usually, I can tell you from my experience, whenever they're standing in front of you, they're all indigent. I'm broke today. I don't have a dime. And I sympathize with the concerns on that last page.
Eventually, we're all in here. Okay, I would like to... Is anybody else here to testify on this bill? Okay, I'd like to get some testimony on 122 also before we have to sign off. But Representative Grimsley?
I just wanted to say one sentence on that last thing. I'm involved in a case now where a person got public defender, and the man walked into the courtroom with a $12,000 Rolex watch on his wrist.
I probably just got it that morning. Okay.
It was a Japanese imitation.
Well, what I want to do is take some testimony on House Bill 122, and then we have a off-net teleconference set up on 114 to start at 2:30, but we can hold that till about 2:35, 2:40. So, Sherry, did you want to?
I would submit some testimony on the first bill, but I would like to.
Is there someone here from the governor's staff to testify on 122? Gail?
Yes, I'm from the governor's staff. A couple steps removed.
Okay,
from
we're not on teleconference. Well, we're going to come back on and off net. I don't know. Whatever you want to do.
Do you want to be on now or?
Doesn't matter to me.
David, this is Frankie.
No, they don't have it signed in a vote. They don't have it.
Okay, just to announce, we're going to probably go off the teleconference now and go on to another bill, and then we'll come back. We have an off net teleconference on a third bill here in about 20 minutes or so. Gail?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Gail Horesky with the Department of Law, Criminal Division. I'd like to address you, if I may, on House Bill
122.
Thank you. Authority to compromise certain misdemeanors. Mr. Chairman, as I'm sure you and other members of the committee are aware, Alaska has a statute which is often referred to as a, quote, civil compromise, unquote, statute. It's in 1245.120. It appears before you on the bill. And it says, in certain kinds of crimes, i.e. misdemeanors, for which a person injured by the act constituting crime has a remedy at civil action, and that is probably most misdemeanors, the crime may be compromised except and under certain conditions. And this is really a very, very ancient statute. In fact, in the transmittal letter that the governor sent over, he cited you to the fact that it was originally adopted in 1900 in Alaska. We say adopted, that's as far back as we could trace it, where it first appeared on our books. And it was modeled, according to the commentary in that 1900 statute book, on an 1813 New York statute. And these sort of civil compromise provisions were very common in the 19th century and in the around the turn of the century. And most states have since repealed them, including New York, upon which ours was originally based. And as far as I could tell, Mr. Chairman, in my research, there are in the neighborhood of 15 states remaining, of which Alaska is one, which still retain this more or less, well, certainly old-fashioned. I don't know. Archaic is a value judgment, but it's the concept behind it is very, very old. Generally, it's not used very often. One of the reasons why it's not used is that in more and more cases, the courts have found that there are social interests involved which take the statute out of the private dispute resolution, for example, DWI. They say, if you're driving drunk and you hit somebody and damage his car, if that person is willing to compromise, that's not enough to get rid of the charge because there is a social interest at stake in that kind of dangerous conduct. It's not merely a private dispute. Where we have been having trouble with this statute most recently is where abusive spouses, abusive boyfriends, abusive in-home live-in people have been pressuring spouses, former spouses, parents, etc., to, quote, compromise, unquote, assault charges that usually are assault charges, okay, like harassment or trespass, through the payment of merely paying their hospital bill, paying for the damage to the car, to the property, whatever, so that the person will drop the charges. And we have taken the position that these were not compromisable on the same theory that the DWI cases are not compromisable. There's a social interest here that goes beyond a private dispute. However, there was a Alaska appellate court case, 1986, State v. Nell, in which the court specifically allowed, in other words, refused to overturn the trial judge's dismissal of a domestic violence assault case in which the offender had pressured the victim into accepting money and civilly compromising the charges. The court was extremely concerned about it, but noted, and I'm quoting, the statute in its current form does not exempt domestic disputes Amendment to create additional exceptions is clearly a matter of legislative rather than judicial concern. They didn't like it, but didn't feel they could change it, because on the clear language on the face of the statute, civil compromise in domestic violence cases was not prohibited. So the language that appears here is taken from domestic violence statutes in other parts of our code, that is the emergency domestic violence injunctions in Title IX, the recording statutes, abuse of elderly, abuse of children, etc. So to include family members, spouses, former spouses, member of the same social unit, i.e. boyfriend, girlfriend, who are living together, all of these crimes would be pulled out of the class of crimes for which civil compromise would be allowed. That's what the bill was.
Yeah, one question, Gail, and then Representative Taylor. You mentioned on DWI is not a civilly compromisable. Where does that show up? It obviously isn't under this set of exceptions.
No, that's a case decision, and I'm not sure if I have the cite on that with me, but I can certainly give you that cite.
I mean, it's obviously a misdemeanor.
Yes.
And this says all misdemeanors are civilly compromisable except, and then we have the list here.
That
just
was
wondering
the Hensel case.
How they got to.
Hensel v. State.
It was a decision, I'm afraid. I'm not sure.
It would be interesting to see the rationale of how they got to that when they seem to get to the exceptions that are laid out in the proposed bill.
Well, the rationale was social damage, not just a private dispute. But now, to answer your implied question, why didn't they come to the same conclusion here? That I can't answer.
Representative Taylor and then Gruber.
We're talking about eliminating some old concepts, and I think the old concept that we're trying to eliminate here is restitution, in essence. If I drive down the street, and Governor Cooper's Palomino is standing out there, and I bump into it, and I break the horse's leg, the horse has to be shot. I feel terrible about it. So does the governor. And I lost my headlight. Now, the horse shouldn't have been there in the first place, and I wasn't doing anything wrong driving down the street, but maybe I was a little negligent not seeing a horse in front of me. So there's apparently great legal arguments that could be made, and we could both hire attorneys and go on and on about this forever, and the police officer, of course, cited me for failing to yield the right of way to the horse. Now, can Steve and I sit down together and resolve this matter? Yeah, today we can. We can sit down and we can figure out what the value of the horse was, how much the damage to my car was, and we can settle up on it. It encourages people to settle up. The current legislation encourages something that I think even rises to a higher level, and that is that it encourages people to resolve their own disputes, and in particular what we would be eliminating here is reconciliation. This will not allow reconciliation. So it should be entitled the Anti-Reconciliation Bill, because no members of family or social unit groups can ever sit down and work it out with the family.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, this bill was part of the same bill as the other bill last year when Representative Thompson introduced it. And I had many of the same problems that Representative Taylor has just mentioned. That Hensel case was actually leaving the scene of the accident. And I represented Mr. Hensel in that case in the Supreme Court. They did it on the basis of just what Ms. Horetsky said. And I think that there's another way to skin the cat. And that is to, and I never understood, and I was never convinced when that bill came up last year, why we needed this law when the court could have simply reached the same conclusion as the court did in the Hensel case. And I think that the problem could be cured instead of saying the language against the spouse, etc., could simply say, add in here, the crime may be compromised in the discretion of the court, except when, etc., etc. And that would cure all of these things, but allow this on a case-by-case basis, because in the domestic relations field, a lot of times you do have compromises, and you can resolve the thing and separate the parties and get them divorced. And if you don't permit it, you're going to have a serious problem. To use the Palomino case, if instead of Governor Cooper's horse, it was Mrs. Taylor's horse, then the thing couldn't have, if this thing passed, it couldn't have been civilly compromised. And I think that there's a serious problem when you can allow the thing to be civilly compromised if it's the governor's horse, but not your spouse's horse. I think they're legal, constitutional questions.
I just note that it takes about a year and a half on the committee not to rise to debate, but Representative Ulmer?
I promise to try, Mr. Chairman, under certain circumstances, not to rise to the bait. However, in this case, because we're talking about horses with broken legs and skinned cats, I have to remind us we're really not talking about those things. We're talking about women, children, and seniors who are not in a very equal position with the batterer or the perpetrator of violence. And so the whole idea of reconciliation, which suggests that there might be somehow two even parties being able to negotiate something quietly and calmly, is totally unrelated to the reality of the circumstance that we're talking about here. So, I don't either understand why the court was not able to find, in this case, as it found in an earlier case, but we now have that precedent to deal with. And given the fact that we have that precedent to deal with, I think we have to follow the court's suggestion that we legislatively address the problem and pass a statute that deals with what I would describe as a situation which is not amenable to reconciliation in more cases than not.
Okay. Do we have anybody else here to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chairman,
Gail, go ahead.
Just one brief comment to follow up on something Representative Bruder said. Sir, my reading of the Nels case is that right now existing law does require court approval. And in fact, in the Nels case, the court could have chosen not to allow the case to be dismissed. In that case, the court chose to allow it, and that's what we were taking up with that decision, or appealing from that decision. So I think that insertion of language in the court's discretion would not change the status quo. My reading of the case is that is the status quo.
Maybe different language.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Taylor, Ruth Lister, did you want to comment? Why don't you just come on up while Rob's making a comment?
I'll make a brief comment. In response to Representative Walmer's comment, I think we're all adults and we understand exactly what we're dealing with here. The problem is we don't really want to talk about it. So let's put it all right out on the table. What we're really talking about is the victim calls a police officer. She's been bashed around. Either she does that from her own home or she does it from the shelter upon the assistance and advice of the shelter personnel who see to it that a charge is brought. Part of the protocol. You can do it, you bring a charge. That gets criminal law involved and things start happening very quickly. Now the charge has been brought, and it's 3 or 4 days later. The wife has decided it's time to leave the shelter, and she has decided not to go along with the advice that she has been given, which is to divorce her husband. And she says, no, I want to put my life and my family back together again. I think he deserves another chance. It has never happened to us before. We've been married for 10 years. He was drunk on his birthday or whatever. And at this point, two advocacy groups step in. That's the people who are bringing this legislation before you. This legislation is not being brought to you by the victims of these offenses. They're the ones who compromised it. And when they compromised it, they made all the helpers mad at them. All the people that helped them at the shelter, and the DAs that went out of their way, and the police to bring a charge, and the police officer who went to their house and got the drunken rascal thrown into jail, and probably had to fight him and get busted up themselves in the process, they are all very offended at this point at the victim because the victim is no longer going along with the program and punitively going after the perpetrator.
Are we hooked up?
That's why this legislation is in front of you.
Why don't you check that out?
You're not going to find a whole bunch of victims who have compromised cases coming in here saying, please take away our ability to compromise this case. That isn't the group that's here.
They don't want to be beaten up.
That's their choice, and what you're going to do by this legislation is say they don't have that choice anymore. They have to go along with what the police officer and the DA told them. And the tragic part is the law is already there. They're just not using it. The police officer does not want to turn now to the victim who reported the crime and now is unwilling to testify. That's what happens. She doesn't just compromise it. She refuses to testify. At this point, he is not willing to bring the charge against her for false reporting.
Okay, we're going to take Ruth's testimony, and then we have an off-net teleconference on 114 we need to take care of, so go ahead.
Well, I guess
Okay, so then we have everybody on the line.
I understand what you're saying, and very often victims, and if you're on
teleconference.
No, we're not on teleconference, but...
We have all people.
Doesn't want to pursue charges, but the reason she doesn't want to pursue charges are not because she doesn't want the violence to stop. And I guess two things. One is that a crime has been committed, and that we have legislation in our statutes that says hitting somebody seriously enough that the police have probable cause to make an arrest is a crime. And then if and it's the state versus the offender in that crime, and that the burden should not be on the victim, therefore, to press charges. That isn't the case in felony offenses, and it should not, I also think, be the case in misdemeanor offenses. In fact, we could come up with victims who have been in that situation, certainly in Fairbanks, where his attorney, the offender's attorney, and the offender have put a lot of pressure on her to simply compromise. She's dealing with, in particular, the attorney, whose language she doesn't always understand, in an intimidating situation. And so she goes ahead with civil compromise and doesn't realize that there will now be no consequences to the offender. She's not trying to get the offender in jail unless it's a situation of sufficiently high lethality that that's what's needed. What she wants is for him to get some help and to stop hitting. When you civilly compromise, there are no consequences at all. He's not going to get into any kind of treatment program, and he's not going to stop his violence. And, the city attorney's office and the DA's office has come up against this several times, with the victim being completely surprised that, in fact, that is the result of the thing that she agreed to. And so I really disagree that it's just advocacy groups trying to push for this, because, in fact, the shelter programs have always been completely clear with domestic violence victims that what we do is we give them options. If we told domestic violence victims what to do, we would be doing exactly what the offender is doing to them, and that is controlling their lives and telling them what to do. We would not be empowering them and enabling them to go through the personal changes where they will be able to live in non-abusive situations. Getting a man into treatment who is an offender actually is your highest chance of creating or helping to create a non-abusive family, and in fact one that will stay together. In the domestic violence program, we do have many families that split up, and we do have many families that stay together. And we're not pushing for people splitting up or people staying together. We're pushing for healthy families. And I think that although this is just a very small part of the whole thing, being able to civilly compromise is very much not in the interest of healthy families.
Okay, Representative Barnes, and then we have to take care of this other bill here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the comment that were offered earlier by Representative Taylor. And let's just suppose, for the sake of argument, that this is a one-time offense, that, in fact, the person got drunk, the spouse started a fight, whatever. And in the process, one or the other bangs the other one on the head. It's a one-time offense. But this is not necessarily an unhealthy family. It's something that just happened one time. What happens to that family under this bill? The husband, if the husband is leaving, go to jail, is there's no way under this bill that she can drop the charges.
Well, there are several points, actually, at which, first of all, an arrest has to be made so that the police have to consider that what the assault was serious enough that they're going to make an arrest. So somebody banging upside the head is not going to be serious enough to make an arrest.
It certainly is.
Yes, it is.
Well, unfortunately,
Bruce from Fairbanks.
Okay, more serious there in Fairbanks. I guess my experience is that that could happen, I suppose, anything can happen. But in fact, domestic violence tends to happen frequently and tends to be ongoing and escalate. And when you have that serious an assault that an arrest is made, there has usually been a precedent of a lot of verbal abuse, intimidation, and smaller amounts or lesser amounts of physical abuse.
Ms. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Barnes, go ahead.
I'm still getting to just that one-time offense. It's never happened before. It's happened now. It's been a healthy family to this point in time. We've had this one offense now. The person's been arrested. They've been taken off to jail. And if the wife wants to compromise under this piece of legislation, it is true she cannot. Isn't that true?
That's correct. And the only other response to that is you still have the judge at sentencing. And if and all the history, including what she had to say and he had to say, and they said this is a one-time offense, and everything pointed towards the fact that it was a completely healthy family, but just all of a sudden he happened to assault her very severely, the judge at sentencing could say that there was going to be a suspended sentence and nothing was going to happen as a result. He still has been arrested, and that has a very serious message. And the message is that you can't hit people.
Well, I also suspect, if I may, Mr. Chairman, that the very serious message that would take place there is what had once been a healthy family will no longer be a family, because if it were me, and I'm sure that I would want to go back into that home, because I'd like to get hit for sure then.
Okay, I'd like to just take Ruth's testimony and comment. So we've got to take care of the...
One thing, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fred Bailbond from Spinard is on the line waiting for us here, too.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned about one thing that hasn't been mentioned. Assuming we're going to take this bill up again, I'm concerned about the lack of some fiscal notes here, and I would like the committee to request them from the district attorney, from the public defender, Office of Public Advocacy, court system, and corrections. Because this bill is going to cost some money. You're going to be putting people in jail, and I'd like accurate information before the committee, and I'd like to make that request.
Okay, we'll get fiscal notes from the criminal justice system.
Thank you.
In the long list here. This bill and 106 will be brought up next Thursday, and I'd like the committee to be prepared at that time to act on the bill one way or the other. So, Ruth, did you have a parting comment here?
Only that I would just advocate very strongly, despite your concerns. In fact, most misdemeanor offenders do not go to jail until I don't think that there is a very large fiscal note where they do go to jail. It's usually in the estimation of the police, and they are seriously lethal cases, and women are getting killed, and women are still getting killed in our state from this. And so I really would like the committee to just to judge the seriousness of what we're dealing with in domestic violence.
Okay, Representative Taylor.
What we're dealing with here is the civil and constitutional rights of all victims in this state. And what we're really saying is, shall the victim continue to have the option and control over their life? That's what we're really saying. In 17 years, I've seen two civil compromises. That's how rare this thing is to begin with. I couldn't count for you the number of people I've seen who refuse to come in and testify, which has exactly the same effect and isn't even addressed here. If she decides not to testify, the case has to be dropped anyway. That's where the big majority of them are. They're not being civilly compromised out. She just calls up the DA and says, no, I'm not going to testify for him. If he goes to jail, he loses the job. We're out of, we can't pay the rent. Doodly-doo, and all the other pressures come in. And the situation raised by Representative Barnes is very rare, what I think. These things are patterns, and I agree completely with your testimony. The tragedy is, am I supposed to take the right of that person away from them? You do that. I'm not compelled to do it.
Okay, we're going to bring this bill, N-106, back up on Thursday. We have about 12 minutes here, and it's the chair's intent to try to move this bill if we can. I'd like to start with some testimony. This is a court system. Judiciary Committee, by request of the court system, I'd like to start with Carla Forsythe and then Fred Ackerton, who are both on an off-net teleconference with us. Go ahead, Carla.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carla Forsythe. I'm counsel to the administrative offices of the court system. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Thank you.
Okay, I have with me Stephanie Cole, who is the deputy director of the court system, who has also been involved in some of these issues and may be able to answer some questions. Mr. Chairman, under existing law, the court is authorized to accept bail bonds with sufficient, with solvent and sufficient surety to secure the appearance of defendants. And under court rule, if a defendant fails to appear in court, the judicial officer is then supposed to set a time to determine if the appearance, the non-appearance has been willful after notice to the prosecutor and to the defendant. And after a hearing, Insurance Division. Ultimately, after investigation, the division can revoke the license if it finds that there's been incompetence or untrustworthiness, but obviously an investigatory process is quite time-consuming. The proposed bill would give the court the ability, after the hearing is already required by court bill, at which a forfeiture decision is made, and the surety has notice of that hearing, after 90 days has elapsed without payment from the surety, the court then could decline to accept bonds. In the view of the court system, this is simply good business practice. If we're not receiving payment, we shouldn't continue doing business with this surety. The court system suggests a minor wording change to the bill which is before the committee, adding words which would clarify that the bond which is being, the relationship between the bond that's being forfeited and the bonds that are now being, that the court is now declining to accept, and I believe you have that language before you. Mr. Chairman, this bill was introduced at the request of the court system. We strongly support its passage, and I'll be glad to answer any questions from the committee.
Okay. Are there any questions, Carla? Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, Carla, this is Max Gruenberg. This is a technical question. It looks to me like the present language in 2163.020 encompasses much, much more than is in this bill. Are we sure that we're not having any unintended effects by repealing all that other language and just putting it like this, because there are all sorts of other bonds that are covered by that statute? This isn't just a bail bond statute, as I see it.
Well, Representative Gruenberg, of course, the main section that we're concerned with is Section B. I just pulled out my statute to check and see if all the language that appears in A is a total revision. If I might just check that briefly.
I guess what I'm suggesting, Mr. Chairman, is since this deals with possibly other aspects of surety law, I would like to have somebody from the Division of Insurance take a look and make certain that this doesn't deal with other things other than bail bonds, because I don't know enough about insurance law to be able to say that with a lot of certainty.
Mr. Chairman, if I might make one more comment. When the court system originally proposed this measure, we proposed it as an amendment in Title 12, which is the source of the court's ability to accept bail bonds. Legislative Council drafted it up as an amendment to AS 21, and it's my understanding that this is not intended to do anything other than address the court's concerns. But we have no difficulty with asking the Division of Insurance to take a look at this. Certainly that's not the court system's intent.
Okay, thank you. Fred, are you there?
Yes, I am, sir.
Why don't you go ahead?
I would like to turn this over to my attorney, Mr. Richard Haggis, who's also on the line, and he can go into detail about this.
Okay, sir, if you'd identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Haggart. I'm an attorney, and I'm appearing today with and on behalf of Mr. Fred Atkerson with respect to House Bill 114. As this committee knows, Mr. Atkerson and his business is deeply affected by any legislation touching on the rights and responsibilities of corporate sureties in this state. He's a bail bondsman, and in fact, at the present time, about the only one who's operating up here. At the outset, we want to make it clear that Mr. Atkerson has doubts about the need for this legislation. At the present time, the Division of Insurance has full authority to regulate corporate sureties, and to Mr. Atkerson's knowledge, is doing so. The problem addressed by this legislation simply does not exist. Properly forfeited bonds are, in fact, being timely paid by solvent corporate sureties. While we know of another bail bonding company that did fail to pay off some bonds, this was because of the bankruptcy of the underlying insurance company. And we respectfully suggest that the legislation sought by the court system in House Bill 114 would have only a nominal effect on reducing losses due to bankruptcy of the surety. Second, it is unclear why corporate sureties are being singled out in this legislation. Most of the bonds issued in the criminal courts of this state are secured by private cash, private property, or private surety. When bonds of private sureties are forfeited, the court system, to our knowledge, has made no effort to collect or enforce on the underlying security. To Mr. Atkerson's knowledge, not one piece of real property has been taken, nor one promissory note pursued, where private sureties have been involved in a forfeiture. When the court system is leaving hundreds of thousands of dollars of forfeited security on the table each year, it is a fair question to ask where the resources and expertise to enforce this particular legislation against corporate sureties will be coming from. Even more important, why is the state focusing on corporate sureties and ignoring the large number of private sureties that have to date been allowed to thumb their nose at the court system without consequence? Finally, the Division of Insurance, which currently regulates corporate sureties in all respects, is fully empowered to act against any corporate surety who acts in violation of state law. It is perhaps worth considering whether the insurance division should explain why it cannot handle its regulatory responsibilities to the satisfaction of the court system. If dividing responsibilities of regulatory measures among different bureaucracies invites mismanagement and confusion, both from a governmental standpoint and for those who are being regulated. Before such a step is taken, it should be clearly demonstrated that there is substantial need for the divided authority. There simply has not been any such showing with respect to House Bill 114. Mr. Atkerson's previous comments have been directed to whether or not House Bill 114 should be enacted at all. If it is to be enacted, however, there are two very vital modifications which must be made in the legislation. First, it must be made explicit that the 90-day period following a forfeiture begins to run only when that forfeiture has occurred after notice and hearing on the forfeiture itself. We were very pleased to hear Ms. Forsyth state that the court system's position was in accord with this suggestion, and we will submit language to make that clear. The reason this change is vital and that we believe it must be made explicit is that at the present time, there are a number of bonds outstanding for Mr. Atkerson's, which, while technically having been forfeited, were done so without any hearing or notice, and we're in the process right now of working through those back bonds, many of them that was not even aware until fairly recently had been forfeited, as trying to figure out what will be done in terms of can you hold a hearing 1, 2, 3 years after the fact, those kinds of questions which are in negotiation and settlement with the court system right now. But as this legislation is currently drafted, Mr. Atkerson could be required to pay all these past forfeitures which have been entered by various judges without hearing or notice immediately upon the effective date of the bill, provided only that they're 90 days old or more. And while that may not be the intention of the court system, I believe that's clearly the way the legislation reads now. The second very important change which needs to be made is to make this bill prospective in effect only. Thus, Mr. Atkerson requests that he be put on notice, and in fact any other bail bondsman, that this legislation would affect only bonds that are issued after a future date certain, preferably something 90 days after the effective date or something of that nature. Consequently, Mr. Atkerson respectfully requests the committee to add a new subsection C that specifically states the legislation covers only surety bonds executed after the effective date of the bill, at a minimum, if it is enacted, period. Finally, a third and a somewhat more minor change that Mr. Atkerson is interested in would be to increase the time between the notice of forfeiture and the date on which some action could be taken by the court system from 90 to 100 days, 120 days, rather, simply to allow a little bit more time for any honest dispute to be worked out without running afoul of a regulatory mechanism. In conclusion, we respectfully ask the committee to look searchingly at this legislation and determine whether or not putting the court system in the enforcement and collection business is appropriate. We also urge the committee to take a good close look at the Division of Insurance, and if they are not, in fact, doing their job, find out why that is the case. We also urge the committee to consider very seriously whether or not the problem perceived by the court system exists to the degree and extent that makes this kind of a legislative solution necessary or appropriate. If some legislation is ultimately necessary, however, the changes Mr. Atkerson has requested in House Bill 114 are vital to the continued existence of his business. While bail bonding is hardly the world's most glamorous profession, it provides an important service in a society where the right to bail is constitutionally mandated. Most of Mr. Atkerson's clients are persons of slender income and limited resources. 200 to 300 people per month are released under corporate surety bond, people who would otherwise fill already overcrowded jails if they couldn't have access to a corporate surety. In this regard, Mr. Atkerson serves an important and useful role in our criminal justice system. Changes he has requested will permit him to continue that role. If they are not adopted in this legislation goes forward, the existence of his business would be unfairly and immediately threatened without advancing any reasonable interest of the state of Alaska or its court system. Thank you for your attention, and Mr. Atkerson and I are ready to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much. I'd like if you could forward to the committee those comments that you've outlined, and I just note that we have a request on the committee to not only look at those, but to take a look at the statute. And Carla, you might want to look at 63020. We're going to ask the Division of Insurance to comment on it regarding all the other entities that are affected in this statute and make sure we're not eliminating something unintentionally. And with that, even though we had a proposed CS here to work on today, I'm going to just hold the bill over till next Friday, and hopefully we'll have it checked out and ready to go one way or the other by then.
This Friday?
No, a week Friday. Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think it's very important, Mr. Haggart, that we get your testimony and that the committee staff distribute it to us in our files. And I'd like the committee staff to make certain you have a look at the draft CS. Obviously, this bill needs a lot of work. It's in bad shape.
Mr. Taylor.
Yes,
Mr. Haggard, if you would also please look at that same section of the law and compare it with the substitute that we have before us and also, of course, with your recommendations. And maybe you could also give us some input as to how, if we're going to pass a piece of legislation on this subject, we can do so without doing damage to many other sections of the law that I don't think are intended by your client or by us to change.
Mr. Chairman, I had the same concern Representative Grunberg did, and I, like him, am a lawyer but not an insurance expert, I guess, because I did not know either what effects the amendment to or the replacement of the existing subsection A with a new subsection A, vastly simplified, would have. I'm not sure, really, that it probably one way or the other is important to the court system's objectives in this bill to change subsection A at all from what it originally was, but I may be wrong about that.
Okay, Carla, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I do have comments, but I'll submit those to the committee in writing.
Okay, I'll have John Hartle and my staff work on that. We're going to send this over to insurance, and John will get together with both you and Mr. Haggerty on the telephone, Haggard on the telephone, and we'll try to work it out. And just in terms of scheduling, I'm going to hold it over to a date certain, which is would be a week from this Friday, and we're going to try to just act on the bills, and either that's ready to go then, or it's going to get held over for a considerable period of time because we're starting to get a lot of bills stacked up in the committee. So, with that, everybody's on notice to act on it, and if nothing further to come before the committee. We're adjourned.
Thank you.
I think to get this bill together is going to take a while. This is a lot.
David, this is Frankie, and you know.